Welcome to another Salvation by Grace Sunday morning message from Grace Christian Assembly. We are currently engaged in a verse-by-verse exposition of the book of Hebrews. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
And now the internet is with us. Speaking of the internet, we need to have a little bit of family talk here before we jump into Hebrews 6 and 7, which is where we're going to be this morning. But you don't have to hurry to get to Hebrews, because we're going to talk for a few minutes. I am an analytical guy by nature, and I am constantly assessing how we do what we do. And when I was at the conference 2 weeks ago, one of the things that I discussed with some of the other pastors there was that they want to know how we're doing what we're doing on the internet. We have a remarkably large internet audience, especially considering that we are a small church tucked away in a little suburb of Nashville that's difficult enough to find, and yet being a little church, we have a growing and remarkable internet outreach. And so we were talking about that. Now, a question came up that is a really interesting question, and I've talked to the deacons about it a bit this week, well, in the last 2 weeks, because whenever somebody brings up a question like this, I assume that somebody else has probably also thought of this question. Somebody else has probably brought it up and wondered about it, and I like to just address things and put them out there. And as I said, I'm an analytical guy. I'm always trying to assess how we do what we do. And I'm very aware, and I completely agree with the Apostle Paul when he spoke of the fact that this word that we preach has that scent of life unto life to some people, and yet it has the scent of death unto death to other folks. That same word as we preach it brings life to some, brings death to others. And so Paul would ultimately say, really, who's up to this? Who is adequate for this job? Because we are just people of clay, mortal, dying folks who get to walk around speaking the really magnificent words of an eternally sovereign God who allows us creatures to handle that word. And really nobody is up to that task. And I am in so many ways my own worst critic. And most Sundays we get done here and I go home and listen again to the message and think about it and always want to redo it and think I should have said this or I could have said that or how'd I miss that? And so I'm always analyzing. So someone said, do you think that the commitment that GCA has to the internet ministry in any way interferes with the local congregational ministry? In other words, is there any way in which the local congregation gets shortchanged based on the commitment that we have to the internet ministry? And so we talked about it. The deacons, Tom and Alex and Tim and I, talked about that question. And we did conclude that we really couldn't think of an example of any place where a local congregate had a need that not only went unfulfilled, but it was unfulfilled because we were just too busy with the internet. That never happened. But I also realized in talking about it that my relationship with the internet listeners is different than your relationship with the internet listeners. Because to you, the internet listeners are just sort of a group of people with no face and no names unless they happen to come by here and visit, which they frequently do very kindly. But there's a large mass of people out there listening that you've just never met, that you don't know, that you don't interact with, that you don't know anything about. And so they become just sort of this polyamorphous mass, the internet. I just used the word polyamorphous mass to describe the internet. Now, the difference between our relationship is that to me, they're not just a group of people, they're individuals, because I do interact with them. I talk to many folks on the phone over the course of the week. I answer email over the course of the week. I'm on Facebook talking to people over the course of the week. And part of every single day for me, and this is an everyday thing, is answering email and responding to people who are listeners on the internet. And so over time, a relationship has built between me and them. Now, I'm very precise in saying that you cannot be a pastor over the internet. Tom and I come out of a large television-based ministry out in Los Angeles. And one thing I learned through observing that and being part of it is that while you can teach through media, television, radio, internet, you can teach that way, but you cannot pastor that way, despite the fact that there are people on the internet who refer to me as their pastor. The reality is that to really be an effective pastor, minister to people, you really have to be able to look them in the eye. Because a large part of being a pastor is sometimes just listening, sometimes just hugging people, sometimes just kissing them while they cry, sometimes just being there while they go through the trial of their life and lending the moral and spiritual support that's necessary to get through the highs and lows of real human life. And I can't do that for some of our listeners who are in Prague or Australia or London or anywhere else in the world or even Texas or really even Kentucky. I can't get to everybody, and it's really impossible to be an internet pastor to people. But what we do in teaching and the way we teach and the method we use for teaching works really well on the internet. And this is one of the things that I told the pastors at conference, was that the reason we have the following we have is because the teaching method that we utilize translates really well to the internet. And so people come and they listen and they learn and then they appreciate what we're doing. Now, I have said for years and years and years that we don't demand money from anybody. We've had visitors come before, and when the service was over, come up to me and say, "Hey, you forgot to take up the offering," because they're just so used to churches taking up offerings. And we don't. We just have a box in the back. And we assume that if you find value in what we're doing, that you'll support it. And that is the same approach that I've taken to the internet listeners. We don't do any of the tricks that TV or radio preachers do where they say, "If you don't give us however many dollars, if we don't have $100,000 by the end of this week, we're going to go off in your city." You know, we don't play any of those games. We just say, if what we're doing has value, then you're going to support it. The same way that if you're walking through a mall and you see a pair of shoes that has value to you, you'll take out your wallet and express that value in order to own those shoes. Same deal. If what we're doing is a value in your life, if it's teaching you, helping you, edifying you, if it's helping you to understand the Bible and helping you to read it for yourself, if you're learning sound doctrine here, then you'll support that because you find value in it. Here's the relationship now between the local church and the internet. In any given month, 3/4 of our financial support comes from the internet. Correct?
Correct.
Tom does the books. Jennifer's done the books. Correct?
Correct.
Now, what's interesting is we've done a little analysis on that, and the per capita, in other words, the individual amounts here at GCA locally, are higher than the per capita amounts on the internet. But there are just more people on the internet. And so we have a lot of people giving small gifts through PayPal or through our PO box. We have a lot of people who might give a $10, a $20 gift. And the assumption is always in Pauline theology that you'll give something. Paul never allows that Christians will just store up for themselves and never give anything to anybody. The assumption is that if God gave his son and his son gave his life and that life gave us the Spirit, that all that giving does not stop when it reaches us. We would then become naturally giving people. But I have never talked about amounts or who gives what. I don't even know who gives what. I don't want to know who gives what, which is why Tom or Jennifer or Alex, the deacons, take care of the money, because I don't want to know who gives what. It's not something that I need to know. But what I do know is we've grown to the point where the internet giving now allows us here locally to do things we couldn't otherwise do were it not for the internet. So since I recognize the financial value of the internet ministry And since I deal with them as individual folks, I do invest a lot of time into the internet ministry. But right here, right now, I will say to all of you publicly, if at any point you feel that my dedication to the internet ministry is in any way shortchanging you, by all means, say so. You know, recently, can I talk about you for a second, Gladys?
Sure.
Okay, I'm going to talk about Gladys for a moment.
You might never get first.
Gladys and James and I went out to lunch several weeks ago, and she and James like to go out to lunch together. They're great together. Word got around to me, you know, that Gladys felt like she hadn't spent enough time, that we ought to spend some time together. And I said, well, that's great. Let's go to lunch. And I thought maybe she had something she needed to talk about. Maybe there was an issue we needed to talk about. No, she just wanted to hang out and have some lunch together. And so we did. It was great. But one thing I said to her was, I said, I apologize that I haven't spent more time with you lately, but I'm like one of those squeaky wheel people. I put the grease where the squeaky wheel is. And if somebody needs me, they need to say they need me, and then I'll make sure to spend some time with them or whatever needs to happen. But I'm not a mind reader. And so don't walk around feeling kind of left out. Oh, Pastor Jim doesn't spend enough time with me. I'm sorry, I just made you all look very pouty, didn't I? But don't walk around saying, gosh, I wish the church spent more time on me, or gee, the church really could help me with this situation I'm going through. We only know that if you say something. So please, by all means, say something, and don't be afraid to say something. Because I think the people in the room who we've ever helped out, and there are certainly a handful of them, will tell you that it's not difficult once you open your mouth. If you just say, I have a need, we'll go to work to see what we can do to help you out or to fix that need. So if you here in the local congregation in any way feel that the internet ministry is interfering with what you need out of GCA, then say so. Now, having said that, if everything goes right, Tim is going to be teaching a series on the life and health of the church body, which is something he started teaching on Wednesday nights a couple of months ago, and I liked it so much that I said, we need more of this, because many folk go to church looking for what the church can do for them. Many folk come to church expecting the church then to serve them, give to them, help them, support them, all of which we're willing to do, but the church is not Alex, Tim, Tom, and me. The church is us collectively, and we need to, in the next phase of our growth and progress as a church body, we need to continue to learn how to take care of each other so that it's not just, I have a problem, go to Pastor Jim. It should be, I have a problem, I'll go to my brothers and sisters. They'll love me, they'll help me. And I'm really looking forward to what Tim is going to teach along those lines, because again, I'm constantly assessing, constantly analyzing, how do we become more biblical, how do we become more Christian, and how do we improve the general health of GCA. So lots of good things are happening, but I just wanted to bring you up to date on where we stand right now locally and on the internet. And I have to tell you all that I just couldn't be more proud of you, you local folk, because if it weren't for you, there'd be no internet ministry. But financially, if there were no internet ministry, we locally couldn't do the things we do. So it actually is a very complementary two sides to the GCA ministry. Understand that?
Yep.
Okay. So I think I can sum that up. If you have a need, speak up. And we'll listen. It's okay. Some folks don't want to speak up because they're embarrassed to say they have a need. But if you can't say that here, where are you going to say that? If you can't come into a room full of other sinners saved by grace and admit that you have a need, then where are you going to admit it? I've always been kind of amused by folks who are kind of afraid or kind of embarrassed to admit that some portion of their life is not going the way they thought it ought to, or that they're having a tough time financially, or that they're having a tough time in their relationships, and they're embarrassed to say it. And then when they say it, they find out, so does everybody else in the room. There's nobody in the room that's actually got it together. We're just really good at pretending, especially Devante. We're just really good at putting on that brave face. Here I go to church on Sunday. I'm dressed up. I'm wearing a tie. I'm doing fine. But you can let down your guard here. You don't have to sing that song, by the way. You can come here and let your guard down because you're among people who are going through the same struggle, because life ain't easy and Christian life is especially difficult. But when you're in here, you're among friends. All right? Hebrews 6, turn there. I've just written two words on the board, elpis and pistis. Those are two Greek words. Pistis is most often translated faith throughout the New Testament. Now, the similarity between these two words should be obvious to you. They share a syllable. This word, elpis, is most often translated hope. The reason I want you to see the similarity here is because the writer of Hebrews, at the end of chapter 6, brings up hope. And we, 21st century Aristotelian thinking Gentile people in America, when we see the word hope, we think, gosh, I hope it works out. We don't have any confidence in it. We're just kind of hoping it goes. Kind of like a kid Christmas morning hoping that he gets a bike, but he's not sure if he's going to or not. Well, that's not the Greek word. And unfortunately, the English language does not have a commensurate English word to translate elpis from the Greek. The word elpis means a confident expectation, a confident looking forward to something you know is going to happen, which is why Paul raises hope into the stratosphere where things like faith exist and talks about hope makes not ashamed. This hope that we have, the writer of Hebrews is going to say, is part of our assurance. And so if you only think of hope as, gee, I hope it's going to happen, I don't know if it's going to happen, I sure hope it does, then you're going to ask, well, how is that assuring? It's not. But the Greek word is a confident expectation and a looking forward to something you know is going to happen. Therefore, he employs this word elpis in talking about the surety of the Abrahamic covenant, which we talked about last week. The Abrahamic covenant was a covenant God made with himself. God moved through the divided animals, and he made sure that Abraham didn't even try to go through the animals. He put Abraham to sleep. So Abraham is prone on the ground, can't move, not going to move. God establishes the covenant. He moves through the animals. As a consequence, the writer of Hebrews says, therefore we can have hope. You go, really? God, by two immutable things by which he cannot lie, gave us this great assurance of this covenant he made with himself, and all it causes us to do is hope? No, it should cause us to be secure, to be assured. And that's what the word means. So we're starting in chapter 6, in verse 16. We covered it at the end of last week. We're going to pick it up so that we can build up speed as we hit chapter 7 this morning. Men swear by one greater than themselves, and with those men an oath given as a confirmation is the end of every dispute. It was very common in the Middle East, since they didn't have contracts or contract law, that men would make oaths. They would make agreements between each other. They would swear. And they would usually swear by something, which is why Jesus walked around saying, don't swear by heaven. That's not yours to swear by. Men would say, I swear I'm going to do this, and if I don't, then cut me to pieces. Or if I don't, you can have my land. Or if I don't, you can do something to me. That promise attached to the swearing is the oath part. So if two of us are making some kind of an agreement, then the greater is the one that they're going to swear by. He's the one that has more stuff. He's the one that has more power. He's the one that can say definitely this is going to happen because he's the greater of the two people. And between the two, once there is an oath given as a confirmation, that becomes the end of the dispute. As a consequence, the writer of Hebrews says, in the same way, desiring even more to show to the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of his purpose, God interposed it with an oath. So God made a promise to the heirs of the promise. Now, this is a Hebrew writing to Hebrews. So who are the heirs of the promise?
Israel.
More specifically, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the forefathers. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were given a covenant repeated seven times. We looked at it last week in the book of Genesis. Seven distinct times God lays out the Abrahamic promise, and he passes it down from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob. So this is a firm promise. It's established on a promise and an oath. So verse 18 says, in order that by two immutable things, in which it is impossible for God to lie, we may have a strong encouragement, we who have fled for refuge in laying hold of the hope set before us. In other words, because we know that God has established this covenant, this unconditional covenant, and has both promised it and established it with an oath, therefore, he said, it's unchangeable. God can't lie. We have a strong encouragement. We who have fled for refuge and laid a hold on the hope set before us. Now, remember the context. Hebrew writing to Hebrews. Remember the promise. The promise is the Abrahamic covenant. The Abrahamic covenant has two aspects. The spiritual aspect, which is through your descendants, all the families of the earth will be blessed through your seed. And then Paul picks that up in the book of Galatians and says, Christ is that seed. Good. We don't have to figure that one out. It's been interpreted for us. Through Christ, all the families of the earth have been blessed. But the other half of the Abrahamic covenant was, you're going to have offspring like the sands of the sea, like the stars of the heaven, innumerable offspring, and they will inherit this very land. And it will be theirs in perpetuity. That's part of the Abrahamic covenant. And so the writer of Hebrews says in chapter 11 that all the heroes of faith in the Old Testament died not having received the promise. So the Abrahamic covenant, according to the writer of Hebrews, is a good, continual, everlasting, unchanging promise from God, sealed with an oath, and yet, as he's writing this, the promise has not come to its fruition. Yes, the spiritual aspect through Christ has, but the physical aspect of being established in their land has not happened. Here we are, living in the 21st century, it still hasn't happened. Jamie this morning read for us from Ezekiel 37, in which God said to Israel, I will raise you up out of your graves. I will be your God. You will be my people. I'm going to establish you in this land. This is a firm promise. All of the prophets of Israel speak with one voice in saying someday God is going to establish the children of Israel on that plot of land. Here we are 3,400 years after Abraham, 3,400 years after the original promise was made. No, Moses is 1,400 years, and it was 430 years before that that the covenant was made. 1,800 years. Good thing I can do math. 1,800 years, and it hasn't happened. No, not 1,800. 1,800 and 2,000. 3,800 years. It's a good thing I can still do math. 3,800 years, and it still hasn't happened. What are we going to say about that? Are we going to say then, well, I guess you can't trust God? Are we going to say God made a firm promise to particular people and he established it with an oath, but he didn't mean it? Or
he meant it for us.
pardon me?
Or he meant it for someone else.
Or he meant it for somebody else is actually a very common theology out there. That he made the promise to Israel, but he meant us. And he didn't mean land, he meant heaven. He didn't mean Israel, he meant church. And therefore, when we come to faith and go to heaven, that's the fulfillment of the Abrahamic land promise. I remember hearing a preacher one time say, in explaining this concept, he said, it would be like this. If I promised Christian here that when he turned 16, I would buy him a Volkswagen, I am not promising you that when you turn 16, I will buy you a Volkswagen. But if I promised him that when he turned 16, I would buy him a Volkswagen, it's not happening. But then when he turns 16, I actually give him a Corvette. Did I keep my promise?
No.
Well, he would argue, yes, I kept my promise by giving him something far better than what I promised him. But then I challenged the preacher who said that. And I said, no, actually, if I were going to tell the same story based on your theology, I would promise Christian a Volkswagen, but then I would actually give Jean too a Corvette. Because that's really the way their theology plays out. He promises Israel, but then he gives it to somebody else, and that's supposed to be the fulfillment. I contend that absolutely every single word of Holy Writ, like Paul said, is theanostos, is God-breathed. It is based in an unconditional covenant that God established with himself, and therefore I contend that absolutely everything God ever promised anyone, he is going to keep his word. People get upset because it's taken him so long to keep his word, but what is time to God? Peter writes that 1,000 years is a day and a day like 1,000 years. Our life is a blink of an eye to God. He has all the time in the world, no pun intended, and all he has to do is ultimately keep that promise and do exactly what Ezekiel said he was going to do. I'm going to bring you up out of your graves. Did he not say, this is the whole house of Israel? Which I will bring up out of your graves, and then you'll know me, and I'll be your God, and you'll be my people. All he has to do is do that someday, and he's kept the promise. And I contend that he's going to keep absolutely every promise and every detail in every aspect of every promise he's ever made. Why do I believe that? Because I really need him to keep every promise he's ever made to me. And I'm not interested in hearing a theology that says the God who makes promises doesn't keep them. And that he doesn't keep them specifically the way he made them. Because he's made me some very specific promises.
Like, he says it very plainly.
And he says it very plainly.
They shall dwell in the land that I have given to Jacob, my servant, where your fathers dwelt. And they shall dwell there. They, their children, their children's children forever. And my servant David will be their prince forever. And the nations will also know that I, the Lord, sanctify Israel when my sanctuary is in their midst.
That's Ezekiel 37.
Right, that's where he...
But there's a similar promise in Zechariah written the same way.
Right.
So it's plain, says Gladys. Now, Gladys's hermeneutic, big word, Gladys's way of reading the Bible and interpreting it is, it means what it says. She didn't go, duh, when she said it, but it means what it says. Because she's willing to stand on God's word and say, this is God's holy, breathed out word for Israel, and whatever it says is exactly what God meant for it to say, and whatever it means is exactly what it says.
He talked to the bones, and the bones did what he said. He talked to the mountains of Israel, and the mountains of Israel will experience what he has said.
So really, what more evidence do we need?
No more.
No more evidence than that. So the writer of Hebrews says this, knowing all that, knowing how strong our encouragement and that we can flee for refuge and lay hope on what is set before us, this hope we have as an anchor of the soul. This, again, is why it's important to understand the word elpis. There's no anchor to, well, I hope it happens. It might not. There's no anchor there. But if you have a firm expectation a firm looking forward to what you know is going to happen, then that is an anchor for your soul. Once God lays out a promise, once God establishes an unconditional covenant with these people, the writer of Hebrews encourages them and says, now knowing what God has promised you, lay a firm hold on that confidently, because you know that it acts as an anchor for your soul, a hope that is sure and steadfast, and one which enters within the veil. And now he's just gone all the way back to Moses and all the way back to temple worship. You may recall that in the tabernacle in the wilderness, there was the outer tent, and there was the outer court. There was the laver of cleansing, which was the first thing that the Levites and the priests would see as they would enter in. They would have the brass bowl in which they could see their reflection, and they would have to clean themselves and wash themselves before they could do anything else inside there. And when they went inside, there was an altar, and there was the table of showbread, and there was another tent inside the outer tent that was called the holiest place, or the Holy of Holies. And inside there was a piece of furniture, a golden box called the Ark of the Covenant, with a kapporeth, a covering over it. And once a year, the high priest would go into the holiest place, and he had to have the blood of a bull, and he had to have a proper sacrifice, a sacrificial lamb and a scapegoat, and he had to have the proper clothing on, even down to the right underwear. God was that specific. He had to have a white turban on his head with a gold plate that said, Holiness to the Lord. And he had to go in on the Day of Atonement, and he had to sprinkle blood around the Ark of the Covenant and on the kapporeth, on the covering, on the place of atonement. And if he did all that correct, God would forgive Israel for their sinfulness for yet another year. And of course, we know from the New Testament writers that that was just a fail-safe God put in place until Christ could get here and actually pay the sin debt. But God, in his magnificent grace, allowed them to at least year by year put off his wrath through this process. But if ever the high priest went into the holiest place and didn't do any of these things right, if he didn't have the proper incense, if he didn't have the right blood, if he wasn't wearing the right clothes, if he didn't have the turban, if he did anything wrong, God would kill him dead. That's how important this going inside the veil thing was. Because the veil separated the holiest place from everything else on planet Earth.
Jim, did that ever happen?
Yes. And as a consequence, the Israelites began tying a rope to the ankle of the high priest, because if a high priest died inside the holiest place, nobody could go in and get him. And so they would tie a rope to his ankle so that if he died, they could drag him out. And yes, it happened. So God is really, really, really serious about this, because inside the veil is the place where men would meet with God. And if God accepted the sacrifice, the pillar of smoke, the pillar of cloud, would come down and rest above the ark, above the kapporeth, between the extended angel wings of the gold angels on top of the ark. And when that pillar landed there, all Israel saw it, and they knew that they were good with God for another year. But if the high priest died, no pillar of smoke, God's not happy, now we're in trouble. And so really what you have, just so you understand the picture, what you have is this little tent and a veil. And only the high priest can go through the veil, and he can only go once a year. Outside the veil is the whole rest of the world. And anybody can go anywhere in the whole rest of the world. But nobody can go inside the veil, except the high priest, and only once a year. Only when God says, and only the person God says. So the writer of Hebrews picks all that up and says, Christ, as our high priest, as our intercessor, formed a better covenant through better blood, based on better promises, and he went through the veil for us, and now he's going to tell us that the veil he really went through was the heavenly veil. Listen to this. This hope we have is an anchor of the soul, a hope both sure and steadfast, and one which enters within the veil where Jesus has entered as a forerunner for us. Jesus went through the veil of death and came out alive. Jesus went to the tabernacle of God and stood as our high priest and presented his own blood as a full propitiation for us. You may recall that in the Gospels we read that when Jesus cried out and when he gave up the ghost and said, "Into your hands I commit my spirit," that at that moment the veil in the temple was torn in half from top to bottom. That veil was a great big physical curtain, very thick curtain, very tall curtain that no man could possibly have torn. And yet at the moment Jesus died, the veil was torn open and the Holy of Holies inside the temple was exposed. Theologians have argued about the significance of that, whether it was to let God out or whether it was to let us in. Either way, the veil was torn, showing that that operation, that way of approaching God, that sacrificial system of taking blood into the holiest place, that's over now. And what's really interesting about it is that since the days of Jeremiah, there'd been no Ark of the Covenant inside the holiest place. So they would just keep that veil up there and just keep doing the ritual, but they had no Kapporeth on which to pour the blood, especially by the time you get to Herod's temple. So when the curtain was torn open, it was like exposing Oz the Great and Powerful as just a man. They tore open the curtain and there's nothing in there. That whole system is done away with. It's finished. Christ is now the high priest. He is now the intercessor. He has gone through the veil. He is our forerunner. Therefore, we now have access to God in a way that we never had access before. Only the high priest could go to God before. We now have access in a way where Paul says, we run to the throne of grace crying, "Abba, Father." I go. Jamie goes. Kelly goes. Devante goes. We no longer need a high priest to go intercede for us. We have the ability to pray to God one-on-one, and we have it through the authority, through the name of Christ, who has opened up the veil for us as our forerunner. And then he says something remarkable. He says he became a high priest forever, since he's now the high priest. Forever. We don't need flesh and blood high priests anymore. We don't need the Aaronic priesthood. We don't need the descendants of Aaron anymore because we have a high priest who ever lives to make intercession for us. You don't get a better high priest than that. When you have a high priest who's always alive and always sitting at the right hand of God interceding for you, well, then you don't get more secure than that. Think of big picture for a moment. Jesus gave his own blood to pay for your sin. Right?
Right.
Good, you're here. Jesus paid for your sin with his own blood. The Father was so pleased with the sacrifice that he raised Christ up from the dead and then raised Christ up to heaven and sat him at his right hand, the place of honor and glory. So Jesus, who paid for your sinfulness, is sitting at the right hand of God and he ever lives as your high priest to intercede for you when you sin. So, he paid for your sinfulness, and when you trip up, when you sin, when you hamartia, you come short of the mark. When you're simply not good and right and holy, which would be us all the time, whenever that's your situation, the one who paid the price of his own life and gave his own blood as a sacrifice for you, that's the same one who's sitting at God's right hand pleading your case for you. In other words, you are really, 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 really saved.
Good news.
Really good news.
We got a good lawyer.
We got a good lawyer because our lawyer, the advocate with the Father, is the judge's son. So that works out really, really well for us. Then to establish this other priesthood, because as soon as he brings up the word high priest, his Hebrew audience is immediately saying, high priest, wait, Only the descendants of Aaron get to be high priest. And Jesus is a descendant of Judah. And there's no question but that he's a Judahite. So since he's not a Levite, and since he's not from the tribe and the heritage of Aaron, he can't be high priest. Not allowed. And yet the writer of Hebrews keeps saying, he's our high priest. He starts right off with, consider the apostle and high priest of our profession. As soon as he says that, his Hebrew audience is saying, no, he can't be high priest. And so he reintroduces Melchizedek and says, he has entered as a forerunner for us, having become a high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. A completely different order than the order of the Levites or the order of Aaron. He now says he's a priest of the order of Melchizedek. Now, this mysterious Melchizedek guy only shows up twice in the Old Testament. Actually, he only shows up once back in the book of Genesis, and then he's referred to again in Psalm 110:4, I think is accurate. Somebody look up Psalm 110 and tell me if that's correct. The rest of you, turn back to the book of Genesis. Keep your finger there in Hebrews and turn back to the book of Genesis. Go to Genesis 14. I've only got a few minutes left. We're going to have to move quickly. Turn to Genesis 14. Psalm 110, verse 4. Somebody got that?
The Lord has sworn and will not repent. Thou art a priest for even after the order of Melchizedek.
Exactly. So there's David's reference to it, which is really fascinating because Melchizedek shows up back here in Genesis, and yet David, writing in the Psalms, says God has sworn and you're going to be a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Somehow David, looking at this little thing we're about to look at in the book of Genesis, draws the connection between Melchizedek and the Messiah to come. The writer of Hebrews, looking back on it, says Christ is that prophet to come who is a high priest, who is the apostle of our profession, and he's a high priest based on the order of Melchizedek. This is a very mysterious thing. So in chapter 14, this is after Abraham and Lot have gone their separate ways. Abraham and Lot went up on a hill, and Abraham told Lot, his nephew, okay, our flocks are too big, our herdsmen are fighting with each other, we need to kind of separate a little bit here. So you pick, and then whichever way you go, I'll go the opposite way. And Lot looks at the fertile plain and goes, I'll take that. That's the really good land. I'll go with that. And leaves Abraham the rockier area to raise his flocks. But what Lot doesn't take into consideration is that Sodom and Gomorrah are cities in the plains. And so Lot ends up in Sodom and Gomorrah. But there's a war, and local kings, warring with local kings, end up taking Lot and his family and the animals, everything, captive. And so Abraham, with his own standing army, giving you some idea how wealthy and powerful he was, with his own army comes barreling into the valley and defeats those kings. And as he's returning from the wars with the kings, we pick up at verse 17 of chapter 14, then after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings that were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley. And then out of nowhere we read, and Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now, he was a priest of God Most High. This is before Moses. This is before the Aaron priesthood was established. This is before Israel ever goes to Mount Sinai and is codified by the law as a nation before God. And yet we read way back here that there is a priest of the Most High God. And he's a king. Now, it says here that he's the king of Salem. That's a translation of shalom. Even if you don't speak Hebrew, you probably know the word shalom. What does it mean? Peace. He's the king of peace. And the writer of Hebrews is going to translate it exactly that way for us. and say he's the king of righteousness, which is the translation of Melchizedek. The writer of Hebrews is going to translate for us. He's the king of righteousness, and he's the king of peace. And he finds Abraham, who just happens to be walking around with this unconditional covenant from God. And the unconditional covenant includes, you're going to have offspring innumerable, even though he has no children at all. And before he has the promised child, he has an encounter with the king of peace, the king of righteousness, who shows up with bread and wine. This is fascinating. Now, he was a priest of the Most High God, and he, Melchizedek, blessed him, Abraham. Now, the writer of Hebrews is going to say, because the greater blesses the lesser, Melchizedek was greater than Abraham, and among the Israelites, there's nobody greater than Abraham. But there is one greater, this Melchizedek. And he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. And Abraham gave Melchizedek a tenth of all the spoils. It's the first tithe you see in the Bible. Abram tithed to Melchizedek. Melchizedek blessed Abram. The writer of Hebrews is going to take all of this and interpret it for us. So go back to Hebrews. That sound that I just made, this sound, is going to make a couple of our internet listeners very happy, because someone wrote to me last week and said, you made some comment the other day that you've become an iPad preacher. I've always enjoyed the sound of your ink and paper Bible flipping as you're teaching. So this is for them.
You have an app for that on the iPad, don't you?
I have an app for that.
Yeah,
I have the paper moving app on my iPad.
I just took away time from us.
Alex points out that I just took away time from the local congregation for the internet people. And naturally, it was Alex who pointed it out. Okay, so now, starting at chapter 7. Gotta go. Starting at chapter 7 of the book of Hebrews. The writer of Hebrews is now going to interpret what we just read out of Genesis, and he's going to interpret it on the basis of what we already know from Psalm 110:4, that way back there, God spoke to the Messiah to come and said, you're going to be a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And God swore that. So the writer of Hebrews says, for this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham as he was returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham apportioned a tenth part of all the spoils, this Melchizedek was first of all, by translation of his name, king of righteousness, and then also king of Salem, which is king of peace. Okay. How many humans deserve the title king of righteousness, king of peace? One? Okay, so who is the one? Jesus is the only one who is called Prince of Peace, ruler of peace. He's the only one who's ever called a king of righteousness. And the writer of Hebrews knows that. And yet he takes the time to interpret it. It says, this one, Melchizedek, this mysterious one who we know nothing about, who just shows up in the book of Genesis and then is gone again, who shows up with bread and wine, who blesses Abraham and then takes a tenth from him, proving that he is superior to Abraham, and then disappears from the record. We read nothing more about him. We don't know anything more about this Melchizedek. But the writer of Hebrews says, but he's the king of righteousness and he's the king of peace. So I contend that what the writer of Hebrews is attempting to tell us is that Melchizedek is a Christophany. Now I know that that's controversial, but as we read the text, Tell me if you can come to any other conclusion than that the writer of Hebrews is attempting to tell us that Melchizedek was a Christophany. And by the way, if it's true that Melchizedek was a pre-incarnate Christ on the planet, then that means that the priesthood of which Jesus is a part is a priesthood that he himself established and that only he can fulfill. Listen to this language. Verse 3. Without father, without mother, without genealogy. What? Now, if he's the king of Salem, and by Salem we mean Jerusalem, then in fact he has a heritage and a mother and a father. If he is an earthly king, some people say that he was actually Shem, that this was just another name for Shem, the son of Noah. If that's true, then we know his father. It's Noah. But the writer of Hebrews takes the time to say, no father, no mother, no genealogy. That's really important because the pedigree for any Israelite, especially a priest, is established by your genealogy. I come from Aaron. I'm a Levite. I can prove my genealogy. Therefore, I have a right to the office. Here he says, no genealogy. Then he goes on and says, having neither beginning of days nor end of life. There you go. Russ goes, well, that's Jesus.
Only been one man without father and mother.
There's only been one man who fits these qualifications, is my point. Who has no genealogy, has no beginning of days, has no end of life, but is made like the Son of God. Well, no. My commentary on that verse was, because it's just that obvious. He's made like the Son of God, and he, Melchizedek, abides as a priest perpetually, continually. Does anybody abide continually? I don't care what your gig is. I don't care what job you have. I just reduced the priesthood to a gig. I don't care what your job is. Does anybody continue in that job perpetually, constantly, if you're a human?
No.
No. Now observe how great this man was to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the choicest spoils, and who indeed of the sons of Levi, and those indeed of the sons of Levi who receive the priest's office have a commandment in the law to collect tenths from the people. We're going to start here next week and pick up this whole tithing thing, but I want you to catch this one more comment, because he then says, that is, from their brethren, although they're descended from Abraham, but the one whose genealogy, he's talking about Melchizedek, the one whose genealogy is not traced from them, from the Levites, collected a tenth from Abraham and blessed the one who had the promises, that's Abraham, but without any dispute, the lesser is blessed by the greater, Abraham was blessed by Melchizedek, and in this case, listen to this, in this case, he's speaking about right now as he's writing to them, as he's writing to the Hebrews, he's saying right now, dying men, mortal men, receive tithes. And that was true. Right then as he was writing, the priesthood in the temple received all the tithes from Israel. This is true. So he says right now, the case is that dying men receive tithes. But in that case, the case of Melchizedek, one received tithes, Melchizedek receiving from Abraham, of whom it is witnessed that he ever lives. He just contrasted everybody who dies with Melchizedek who ever lives. What human lives up to those qualifications? There's just not one. I think the writer of Hebrews is going to pains to explain that the Melchizedek priesthood is a priesthood that only Christ could establish, because again, what human could establish a priesthood that Christ is the fulfillment of? I believe that Christ established his own priesthood, because only he could. And then David in Psalm 110:4 says that God established it as a promise that he would always be a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. And then the writer of Hebrews picks it up and says, he has no father, no mother, no genealogy, no end of days. He ever lives, and he's the Prince of Peace. He's the King of Righteousness. And here's the really, really, really important part. I said all that to say this. God made a promise to Abraham. You're going to have a seed. Through your seed, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. Your seed is going to be innumerable, and I'm going to bring them back to this land. God made that firm, unconditional promise to Abraham, and none of it came true. None of it came true until he had an encounter with Melchizedek. And after he is blessed by Melchizedek, then we read that he gets the promised child, and all the promises start happening. Because, as we read in the New Testament, all the promises of God in Christ are yes and amen. Even when God made the unconditional Abrahamic covenant, it took Christ showing up and blessing Abraham in order for the promises to come to their fruition. I don't know who it is that doesn't read the Old Testament. There are churches out there who kind of say, well, we're a New Testament church, we don't read the Old Testament, but if you don't see the gospel in the Old Testament here, you're just not looking.
You have a Christophany ratifying the Abrahamic covenant.
How firm does that make the Abrahamic covenant?
How relevant?
How relevant does it make the Abrahamic covenant?
It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. Now, have I gone too far? Did I say anything that the Bible doesn't say? Did I connect the dots inappropriately?
We know that God, that Jesus, is prophet, priest, and king.
Prophet, priest, and king. Yes, and this is an example of it, absolutely. Melchizedek is the forerunner, the establishment of the priest and king offices that he's going to take over.
Jim, I'd just like to say this, Melchizedek's always been a mysterious character in the Bible, and you explained it beautifully.
Well, thanks.
I have never heard that before.
And suddenly, a smattering of applause. Next week, we will pick right up at he paid tithes, because this is one of the places that people who teach tithing love to go and say, look, that's before the law. Before the law, Abraham paid tithes. Therefore, when the law came and went, that didn't do away with the tithing necessity. And you know that I don't teach tithing. And in fact, there is a very consistent biblical response to that. So we'll talk about that, but we'll also talk about the importance of the fact that he tithed, because the writer of Hebrews is going to say the entire Aaronic priesthood and all the Levites were actually in the loins of Abraham when Abraham tithed to the greater Melchizedek, showing that even the Aaronic priesthood is subservient to the Melchizedek priesthood. So there's a big theological statement to be made there as well. Yes, MJ.
Well, this is just a very Jainism, but it seems to me that if we humble humans do just a little bit to try and do God's will, we get all the blessings of the covenant. Like, we give one little tenth, and we get all this great stuff.
Yeah, that would be a Mary Jainism.
Yeah, okay, I'll shut up now.
No, but you're absolutely right. If we really understand the Bible aright, if we're really reading the magnificence of God's grace in the text, then it's not even we do this little bit and we get all these blessings. It's we get all these great blessings and we offer back our little bits.
Yeah. And he gave it to us anyway.
And he gave it to us anyway, exactly. You're not giving back to God anything he didn't first give to you.
Right.
And there's nothing you're ever going to be able to give him that's commensurate with what he's given you.
Exactly.
And so we spend the rest of our life praising and thanking, worshiping and glorifying him, and we do it with our heart and our mind and our strength. We do it with our means, we do it with our money, we do it with our lives. But all of that is just a response to the fact that he's been remarkably kind in everything he's already done for us. Never is he the one responding. Never do we take our little bit and he blesses us abundantly in response, which is the way giving is far too often taught. It's always he has blessed us remarkably. What should your response be? And really, what's enough? What's a big enough response? You know, I gave him half of everything I have. So he gave you everything he had.
gave you his son, and his son gave his life. Really, you think half of what you have makes up for that? You can never, never, never give enough to say thank you. But we'll spend the rest of our life trying and worshiping and praising.
We thank you for joining us for this Salvation by Grace message. For more information, please visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And join us next time as we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.